This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director, Alicia Graf Mack. Plus, five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around to the very end of the episode to get a rundown of the latest news. But first, understandably, much of the conversation about Iran is dominated right now by the logistics of war and passage through the Strait of Hormuz. But there's another piece that we should talk about. When war happens around the world, it doesn't just threaten lives. It also puts history itself at risk. Priceless artifacts, ancient landmarks, and entire cultural institutions can be damaged or lost forever. But there are local archaeologists and other experts who are actively working to protect that history in real time. And that's who we're talking to in this episode. Our panel will share what it takes to document and safeguard museums and heritage sites in the Middle East, Ukraine, and beyond, and why preserving these stories and objects matters so much for future generations. At the table was Gil Stein, who's a professor of Near Eastern Archaeology at the University of Chicago and director of the Chicago Center for Cultural Heritage Preservation. Morag Kursal, who's an archaeologist and professor of anthropology at DePaul University and founder of the Follow the Pots Project. And Patty Gerstenblith, who's an emerita professor of law at DePaul, who serves as president of the U.S. Committee of the Blue Shield International. The nonprofit works to protect cultural property from theft or destruction during armed conflict and natural disasters. Now, preserving history and cultural heritage, those are very broad terms. So, to get a sense of what we're talking about, Professor Stein kicked things off with an explainer.
Cultural heritage is it's a combination of things, really, that material monuments, ancient sites, museums, cities, things that are in the built environment that basically are iconic things. They define who we are. Like, the best example I can give you is to think about the Statue of Liberty. That's an iconic object. Anyone can look at it and instantly they'll know that's the United States of America. That's who we are. It helps define who we are, and it's very valuable and irreplaceable. And there is also intangible heritage, which is things you can't actually touch, but it's things like the myths, the legends, the dances, the folklore of a people. And cultural heritage makes us who we are. It defines a society. And if you think about if you didn't have cultural heritage, instead of an American society, we just have a bunch of people living next to each other with no connection.
Right. What can you add to that, Professor Kursal?
I think it's also something that brings people together. You know, people are drawn to particular aspects of their lives that they share in common or that they may not share, and then they're very interested in figuring, you know, in understanding each other's pasts and futures based on what their heritage is.
Yeah. And I mentioned that, you know, the war in Iran, which we know is actively still ongoing, Professor Stein. I mean, what should we know about cultural heritage there? What would you say?
Well, cultural heritage is very, very fragile. And you should think about it like petroleum. It's a non-renewable resource that once it's gone, it can never be replaced. And because cultural heritage is so important to people, when there's a war, the other side goes to war, not just with the people, but it goes to war on the heritage. So the way the Taliban blew up the Bamiyan Buddhas, or the way the Nazis eradicated any monument that had to do with Jews, or the Russians trying to eradicate the physical heritage of a country in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is deliberate destruction of the enemy's cultural heritage, but a lot of it is, I love the term, collateral damage. It's not intended, but it just happens during wartime. And a place like Iran is one of the richest ancient civilizations in the world, one of the richest sets of thousands of archaeological sites that they define for a modern-day Iranian their own glorious history that goes
right
back to the Persian Empire. And so it's a target in wartime, but it's also vulnerable in wartime.
Professor Gerstenblith, I mean, picking up where Professor Stein left off, talk about the sites in the country that are most at risk and whether they're protected under the law.
Well, there's something called the UNESCO World Heritage List, which contains about 1,500 cultural and natural sites throughout the world. Iran has about, I think it's 29 sites that are listed as World Heritage Sites, and some 49 more that are tentative World Heritage Sites. So these are the most obvious ones that have achieved what's called outstanding universal value. But that really understates the real cultural heritage of any country. Where there are probably thousands, if not tens of thousands, of additional historic structures, religious centers, and archaeological sites, and particularly the latter have not necessarily yet been recognized, excavated, so that they could be listed on such a site. So there is such a list. There is international law protection. The 1954 Hague Convention, to which the United States, as well as Israel and Iran and many, many countries throughout the world,
mm-hmm,
are state parties to. This prohibits the targeting of cultural sites unless excused by military necessity. What exactly military necessity is, unfortunately, is in the mind of the beholder. It's not well defined under international law.
Interesting.
But I'd like to add, if I can, to essentially what Gil was mentioning, which is the issue of collateral damage.
Yes.
So the 1954 Hague Convention prohibits, as I said, the intentional targeting in the absence of imperative military necessity. But we and international law recognize that there could be a legitimate military target, and then a cultural site is damaged or destroyed, even while it is only the legitimate target that's being attacked. So in the case of what happened in Tehran and Isfahan over the past 2 weeks or so, from what we've been able to tell, the damage caused to those, and those are World Heritage Sites, was caused by an attack on some other target nearby. And the strength of the bombs was so great that the reverberations were, in fact, what caused the damage. But even that is limited, the idea of collateral damage is limited by other principles of international law, which have arguably become part of what's called customary international law, which is international law that binds everybody, regardless of whether they have ratified a particular international instrument. These principles establish, among, there are three of them, but establish that even in a situation where there is a legitimate military target, but damage to cultural heritage can be anticipated, the expected military advantage, or I should put it the other way around, the expected damage or collateral damage to an historic site has to be proportionate to the military advantage that is expected to be gained. Mm-hmm. So we can't really judge. We don't know what those other military targets were. We don't can't judge it. I should add, the second of the three principles is feasibility, which is you should avoid damage to cultural sites to the fullest extent possible.
Professor Kersal, I mean, the risk isn't just destruction by warfare, right? There's also the issue of looting and theft.
Right. And we know this most, we have the best evidence of this after the post-2003 Iraq coalition forces invasion of Iraq, where, you know, you have a breakdown in governance and then people turn to looting. And people turn to looting of both museums and archaeological sites because there's demand. And the demand is predominantly in the West and mostly in places like the United States and in the UK and also in the in the Gulf states, which is becoming increasingly more a place where people are demanding artifacts. Mm-hmm. So one of the elements is that, you know, people turn to looting maybe for a variety of reasons, but not the least of which is because they know there's a ready market for these artifacts that are dug up or stolen from museums.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your organization, Follow the Pots.
Sure. So Follow the Pots is a project that I work collaboratively with the Department of Antiquities in Jordan and with Meredith Chesson of the University of Notre Dame and Chad Hill from University of Pennsylvania. And we have been monitoring change over time at some archaeological sites along the Dead Sea Plain in Jordan, which have actively been looted for over 30 years. And people want the pots from those sites because one of the sites has been tentatively identified as biblical Sodom. And everybody wants a pot from the city of Sin, which is a direct quote from one of my informants, because I use my anthropological hat and do ethnographies with people. And I'm very interested in, the project is interested in figuring out how artifacts go from the ground to the consumer. And the mm-hmm. consumer can be both the individual, so you and I could buy one online today, or the institution, and museums, other kinds of educational institutions who are also interested in acquiring these things.
Professor Stein, you led an effort to document and protect cultural heritage in Afghanistan. Can you talk about the lessons learned from that conflict and its impact?
Well, I spent 8 years going back and forth to Afghanistan, working with the U.S. State Department to help preserve Afghan cultural heritage, which had been horribly damaged during the Afghan Civil War after the Soviet invasion ended with the Russian withdrawal.
And tell me some of the specifics that were lost.
Yeah. Well, the National Museum was sort of ground zero for this, just like the National Museum in Baghdad was a ground zero for looting. And there is an estimated 140,000 objects in that museum, which was terribly looted. Mm. So we were working to help the museum rebuild itself by, they had no idea what they even what still remained in the museum. So we did a computer inventory of every object in that museum. And we did it in Dari, the local language, and in English. And now that material is protected. So we worked with the museum to help them. We also did a project using satellite imagery to map every archaeological heritage site we could find in the country of Afghanistan. And when we started, the Afghans themselves knew about 5,000 of them. Mm-hmm. By the time we were done, we had mapped 29,000 of these archaeological sites all over the country.
Wow.
And the third thing we did was we were very interested in heritage education, because most Afghan school kids don't know the history of their own country.
Is that so?
Yeah. So we trained Afghan colleagues to go out to high schools in the six largest cities of Afghanistan to teach about the civilizational heritage of Afghanistan, because it was very important for us to try and change the perception of Afghanistan as a place of war, to have people recognize, no, this is also a place of tremendous cultural richness, and it's worth preserving that richness.
Professor Gerstenblith, tell us about your work with the U.S. Committee of the Blue Shield.
Sure, but I'll explain first what the Blue Shield is, because that may not be familiar. It's not the health insurance company. It is a symbol that was adopted as part of the second protocol to the Hague Convention and actually goes back to the main convention as well, that it is a symbol that can be used to mark protected cultural property. Significant cultural property is protected even if it's not marked, but it is this internationally accepted symbol for signifying protected heritage. The Blue Shield movement now consists of an international umbrella organization and now about 34 national committees. And obviously, I'm talking about the U.S. National Committee. Our work has been a little bit different. In the past, we have liaised a lot with the Department of Defense. Some of the members of the Blue Shield have done trainings mm-hmm. with members of the military, particularly those who are going to deploy. But we have also worked with the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, which is responsible for creating lists of, in our case, of course, cultural inventories of sites that should not be targeted. We sometimes call those no-strike lists. Although those lists are then sent to the combatant commands, in the case of Iran and Iraq,
right,
that's known as Central Command, CENTCOM, and they make the ultimate decisions of what can and cannot be targeted. So we have worked a lot with the Department of Defense to hold them accountable, at least in the public eye, as to what they are doing
right.
or not doing.
Well, Professor, I got to get your reaction to this then. As you talk about the Department of Defense, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said earlier this month that the U.S. military would not follow, quote, stupid rules of engagement. What did you think of that?
Frankly, I was horrified. Rules of engagement are the rules that are promulgated to instruct the military in context with particular conflicts of how basically what they can and cannot do in line with international law. And this is not just about cultural property. This is also in line with what are known as the Geneva Conventions, which provide things like protection of civilians, protection of prisoners of war, like you can't poison civilians' water supply, you cannot target civilian infrastructure, you know, as well as protecting cultural property. So,
I mean,
frankly,
it's really just something civil society would do, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's, and to make a statement like that indicates to everyone else in the world that we're no longer going to abide by these, you know, civil humanitarian, it's just.
I can see you visibly frustrated.
It is so frustrating and infuriating.
Right. Yes. But I want to add to that, that it's not just a matter of international law. A lot of these principles from international law have been incorporated into U.S. domestic law. I fully appreciate Professor Kersel's frustration and share it. But I think to bring it home is that violating these principles is at a minimum a war crime. When they are violated, you know, knowingly, intentionally, whatever. Saying we're going to throw out the rules of engagement implies an intentional decision to violate these rules, or at least not to follow them.
Right.
And so, you know, we really are starting to talk about, you know, obviously we'd have to look at individual circumstances, but we're starting to talk about the commission of war crimes, mm-hmm. which is something that I, you know, has happened in U.S. history by the U.S. military. Not that it's never happened, because it has, but happens very rarely. And when it has happened, has generally been condemned.
Yeah. Let me get your thoughts on this discussion here, Professor Stein.
Well, we were talking about how valuable cultural heritage is as something that defines a people's identity, and it's what holds them together. In our war in Iran, we've made a distinction. Oh, we want the people of Iran to rise up against their government and to develop a new state apparatus. But I can tell you that destroying the cultural heritage of Iran, there is no better way to ensure that the people of Iran, the people we say we're going to help, it's guaranteed that they will hate the United States basically forever for destroying the things that are most precious to them, the things that are, hey, that's who we are, and you've destroyed it.
And Professor Kersel, I mean, you were talking to our producer before this conversation and discussing our duty of care toward cultural heritage at risk from war and looting. What are the stakes?
I mean, it's really about individual and collective well-being. The stakes are our universal understanding of what the past is and how what it means to individuals and to collective agencies. And so it's really, you know, the stakes are really high, and we seem to have decided not to care. And I think that's really problematic, from especially from a governmental standpoint.
Well, let me hear from all three of you here as we close the conversation. And this is for the listener who's still trying to piece this together. Why should we care? What do we lose here? You want to go first, Professor Kersel?
Well, I mean, as a, you know, a professor, we lose the ability to teach the next generation about the past. If we eradicate elements of it, it no longer exists. And but, you know, first and foremost, it's also the eradication of the collective well-being of individual of peoples who have lost their heritage.
Professor Stein?
I would say it's very important for us to recognize that when you talk about cultural heritage of a place like Iran or a place like Iraq or a place like Afghanistan, you're not just talking about the monuments of that country. It's really, as Morag was saying, a collective thing. It's our world cultural heritage, that almost everything that's the roots of who we are as in Western culture, Western civilization, the roots of all of that are in places like the Middle East, in places like Iraq, which is ancient Mesopotamia, or the Persian Empire. The monuments there are part of our own collective heritage.
Like, right.
And that's worth protecting. Our world heritage is worth protecting in these places.
Last word to you, Professor Gerstenblith.
So Professors Kersel and Stein have already very well expressed what we lose in terms of understanding our past, losing part of our shared humanity, and losing our ability to pass this on to future generations. But I'd like also to add, at this point in time, we also risk losing the rule of law. And once we lose that rule of law, what have we become as a country and as a civilized society? That way, I think, leads to a real loss of our own identity and our own sense of who we are and who we ought to be.
Patty Gerstenblith is an emerita professor of law at DePaul University and former faculty director of the Law School Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law. Gil Stein is professor of archaeology at the University of Chicago and director of the Chicago Center for Cultural Heritage Preservation. And Morag Kersel is an archaeologist and Galilee Prehistoric Project and the Follow the Pots Project as well. Thank you all so much.
Thank
Great
you.
Discussion.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and 5 focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director, Alicia Graf Mack. Plus, 5 Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
turn now to the top news stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane and WBEZ Arts and Culture reporter Courtney Kippers. The city streets are being taken over by robots, delivery robots, that is. Claire started us off with an update on one that ran into and shattered a CTA bus shelter. Here she is.
A video of one of these delivery robots just plowing through and breaking the glass of a Westtown bus shelter is having its moment all over the internet
right now. Those bus shelters need to get out of the way.
Yeah. And then they get confused, and then the glass is sort of all over them, and then they're sort of going back and forth and back and forth. It's chaotic.
Oh, my goodness. So it's two different companies, right? Two different robots from Serve Robotics and Coco. And they're both companies are operating under a pilot program. Is that right, Courtney?
Yeah, that's right.
And yep. It hasn't been without its critics. You have people who love them. You have people who hate them.
Certainly, yeah. We've seen some pushback. There's a petition going around called No Sidewalk Bots, and that has more than 3,600 signatures, according to its website, from people across the city. And they want that pilot program that you're talking about paused until the city can gather and release a study on the safety and accessibility impacts of these bots.
I actually tried to move one once, physically.
You physically tried to pick
yes,
it up?
The
robots are strong.
This was on Grand Avenue. They are little tanks. I mean, totally. I got my hands around it and sort of changed its direction, but I really couldn't lift it or move it.
Was it coming in your direction?
Yes, it was coming right at me.
It was coming at you.
Yes,
and
it was coming at me.
You didn't want the fate of the bus shelter, of course, so
of
you said,
course.
Let
I
me
was keeping
protect
our
the bus
streets
shelters.
Safe at all costs.
Yeah.
And we're seeing them in Old Town, too, we should note. There was the shelter in West Town and then Old Town that they just slammed through.
Wow, that's interesting.
Well, I will say, Sasha, here's my little scoop. I drove by so-called bus shelter, or the bus shelter in question, mm-hmm. on the way in, and it looked like this never happened. It's like cleaned up.
Oh, kinda so they
wild.
Fixed it really quickly.
We're back. We're so
okay.
back.
All right, City of Chicago. All right. Now, speaking of Chicago, let's talk about our transit system. They just had a major win. Fill us in on that, Claire.
That's right. And we touched on this a bit yesterday on your show, Sasha. CTA likely going to recoup some funding. A federal judge has ordered the U.S. Department of Transportation to resume about $3 billion in grant funding to the CTA. Sometimes reporting that this judge granted a temporary restraining order that barred the federal administration from continuing to hold these funds. Mm-hmm. This was all related to funding last October that was halted, all part of Trump's sort of DEI overhaul, the DOGE committee.
And what was the funding going toward?
This was going through construction. So the CTA Red Line expansion, as well as Purple Line projects. So CTA filed a quick lawsuit, and this funding is supposed to be coming back our way.
Courtney, in other news, a former employee at DCASE, that's the city's Department of Cultural Affairs, she's filed a lawsuit against Chicago. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. Kim Grigsby is DCASE's former first deputy commissioner, which is that department's second in command. She was fired from that post on February 27th. And then last Friday, she filed a wrongful termination lawsuit in Cook County Circuit Court. And that suit names both the city and DCASE's leader, Kenya Merritt.
Mm-hmm. So what's she alleging exactly? And what is the city, I guess, saying in response?
Sure. Yeah. Grigsby says that she was subject to a concerted campaign of professional isolation and systematically stripped of her duties. She says in the lawsuit that in February, she filed a formal complaint with the city's HR department and the Office of Inspector General. And then 1 week later, she was fired. And her lawsuit alleges that that 7-day window between filing those protected complaints and being fired is clear retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
As of Monday, the city said that it had not been served the complaint and that the city does not comment on pending litigation.
Yeah, DCASE seems to have been going through a kind of an unstable era. Would you say so?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say that that's a fair assessment. I did just really quickly, Sasha, want to remind folks what DCASE is, because
yeah.
I think some people don't know that name, but they certainly have interfaced with the department's work. DCASE puts on these large downtown events like the Millennium Park movie series and concert series, plus Taste of Chicago, Jazz Fest, Blues Fest.
Right.
So it really is responsible for so much of the city's cultural scene. It also gives out grants to artists and arts organizations. And like you said, it's really been a turbulent era over there. The mayor's previous handpicked commissioner resigned last October.
Yeah.
And that came with allegations from staff of bullying.
Yeah. And you'll have an update on that piece in just a moment. Claire. Another day, another corruption story. Tell us what's happening over at the Chicago Housing Authority.
Yes, so this is a bit of a scoop by BEZ and the Sun-Times, but the Chicago Housing Authority's board commissioner, Deborah Parker, is essentially being accused of fraud. A 62-page scathing report that we were able to dive into pretty deeply and review shows that Parker receives essentially a housing subsidy from the CHA to rent a home on the South Side. Mm-hmm. But then there was this internal CHA investigation, interviewing of CHA employees that found that Parker failed to report the income of members in that household, including her daughter, who works as a CHA contractor or previously worked as one, and she had $1 million in earnings.
Oh, wow. So I'm sure Deborah Parker is trying to defend herself on this one. What is she saying?
100%. So the CHA right now trying to revoke this subsidy still hasn't been able to successfully do that as far as we know. But Parker has filed a court action to keep it. So more to come.
Mm-hmm. Other stories that you're following this morning?
Are you a fan of cinnamon rolls?
Oh, I love cinnamon rolls.
Well, there is a legendary cinnamon roll establishment in Chicago, been here since the 40s, and Sather. You might have heard of it.
Yes.
In Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood, it is moving.
Oh, okay.
It is leaving its Belmont at 909 West Belmont address because of a 5-story apartment project that is going to take over where it currently is. So this is owned by Tom Tunney, a former alderman, but he told Chicago Block Club that the current location is going to close, but they're going to be moving not far away.
Okay. Well, that's cinnamon rolls. I thought you were going to say something else, so good.
The cinnamon rolls are here to stay.
I love me some cinnamon rolls. That's like the thing to do when you go to the mall even, right?
And these are epic. So, yeah. I mean, it's a thing that people travel here for. The neighborhood loves it, so they're going to find a new location to keep the people happy.
Keep the folks happy.
Give the people what they want.
All right, Courtney, let's go back to DCASE, our city's Department of Cultural Affairs. So there's a new leader, it sounds like, right? Because you talked about what happened with the past leader. Is there someone replacing her now?
Yeah, that's right. Kenya Merritt has been in this role on an interim basis since October. And last Thursday, Mayor Johnson said that he's going to appoint her to permanently stay in that job. That appointment is subject to city council approval. Mm-hmm. Little bit about Merritt. She's a Chicago native. She grew up in North Lawndale, and she's had a long career so far with the city. She's been in various city roles for 25 years, including a previous stint at DCASE. Most recently, she served in the Johnson administration as a deputy mayor.
Mm-hmm. What has she said about what her focus is going to be? Because I'm sure she's aware all eyes are on her right now. This is pretty big coming after all of that uncertainty.
Yeah, definitely. I talked to her in December, and she told me she was focused at that time of sort of reestablishing communication norms internally in that department that had gone through a lot of turmoil. And she's talked several times in the months since about strengthening the perception of Chicago's cultural scene as an economic engine in the city that comes in a moment when the arts really face some precarious funding.
Mm-hmm. We'll leave it there. WBEZ's Courtney Kippers and Claire Lane.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.